This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Western nations are pledging more weapons for Ukraine, but many say it's not enough.
You don't get credit for what you did in the first year of the war. You get credit for what happens in the last year of a war.
Also ahead, Venezuela's runaway inflation. More tech layoffs and incredibly long games at the Australian Open.
The tennis ball has changed this year. I mean, the longer you play, the more rallies you play, the fluffier or the bigger the ball becomes and it's slower.
I'm Carol Hills, plus King Ram, the Iranian podcaster in exile who seems to be getting under the skin of the regime in Tehran. He's also attracting a huge following in Iran who initially didn't get him.
But the more I talk, the more people connect it to, I guess, the method of my madness.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Defense officials from the U.S. and Europe met today in Germany but failed to come to an agreement on something Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky desperately wants, German-made Leopard tanks. Earlier today, Germany's new defense minister, Boris Pistorius, threw cold water on the idea. He said Germany's government had still not made a decision whether to send tanks. But he added that Germany will not stop supporting Ukraine. Joining me now is Michael McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador to Russia. Ambassador McFaul, it's not as straightforward as Germany saying no to sending tanks. There's a lot of things going on here. Tell us about it.
Well, there are lots of sticking points, which I find all to be rather tragic. But yes, they want replacement tanks before they'll transfer the Leopards. They're not the only country that has these tanks, by the way. Other countries want German permission before they think about the decision to send tanks. But I find it all disappointing because this is a moment, this is a turning point in the war in Ukraine. They need these weapons and they need other kinds of weapons to go on the offense. If you listen to their commander-in-chief, General Zaluzhny, if you listen to President Zelensky, this is the critical year, 2023. Where they think they have a real chance of liberating their territory, but they need these weapons and they need them now. They don't want them in June. They don't, you know, they're thinking, deliberating. And I would just remind you that we had these kinds of moments throughout 2022 when there were big fights, big deliberations about whether this weapon system or that weapon system would lead to some kind of escalatory response from Mr. Putin, and they never did. And I just think rather than doing it in an incremental way all over again in 2023, this is the year to give everything right now to have a breakthrough effect in the war rather than incremental support for the Ukrainians.
And so you think Berlin is really concerned about stoking hostility from Putin and stoking a response, that's what the concern is in Berlin?
It's one of the concerns, yes. It's not just about supplies. And here I think we need to be blunt. Mr. Putin has been successful at deterring the West from providing certain weapon systems by alluding to and at times threatening to use nuclear weapons. Some people look at what he said and alluding to the use, you know, they might have to use nuclear weapons if they lose this war. And people think, oh, that's irrational, they're crazy. I don't see it that way. I see it as a very concrete messaging to deter us from providing tanks, from providing long-range missile systems, from providing fighter jets. And so far, they've been successful at deterring us from providing those kinds of weapon systems.
You're now part of an international working group that provides guidance on sanctions targeting Russia. Your latest work was on the Russian oil price cap. What action have you urged, and has it been followed?
Well, this is a non-governmental international group that I coordinate. We got together at the beginning of the war with the simple idea that sanctions needs to be a big part of the pushback on Russia. We've written 10 papers to talk about things that the West should do. And in the same spirit, I would say I'm deeply impressed with what the coalition did. It's not just the West, by the way. Japan is involved, and they've achieved tremendous outcomes. The Russian economy is suffering as a result of sanctions, particularly what the West has done with respect to oil and gas sanctions have been fantastic. And at the same time, I think there is more to be done in 2023.
But regarding the Russian oil price cap, what action have you urged?
We were advocates of the price cap a long time ago. We also urged, by the way, an import tax, which I think is another thing that should be considered in 2023 to reduce the amount of money that Putin has to conduct his invasion in Ukraine. And the price cap and the oil ban in Europe, again, I give Europeans a tremendous amount of credit. It's having that effect. Putin has, I saw one estimate the other day, $170 million less every day to fight his war than he did before the price cap and the oil ban. You know, so congratulations on that. But I think going forward, the price cap should be lower. Right now, it's at $60 a barrel. And our working group put out a paper recently. We think it could go to as low as $30 a barrel.
Are there still pressure points that Western allies could put on Putin in terms of sanctions that could realize some real benefits?
Oh, absolutely. The price cap could be lower. Thousands of Russian oligarchs and Russian government officials and Russian soldiers and their families could be put on the individual sanctions list. Sanctions against all state-owned enterprises should be put in place. I think the financial sanctions should be dramatically increased with respect to Russian banks. It was good that was what was done, but I think it should be increased. You could set up one or two banks to be off of that list, those that finance, for instance, the export of Russian fertilizer and Russian food. We don't want that to happen. But that the financial sanctions could be tightened in many, many ways.
The blockbuster sanctions from the West early in the war focused on Russia's financial system. You know, almost a year later, a lot of European banks still haven't left. What's going on there?
Well over 1,000 companies did leave, and many of them left billions of dollars in investments inside Russia. They weren't even forced out by sanctions, by the way. They just decided in this era, it's immoral and not good for their public relations to be doing business with Russia. But some stayed. They want to get back to business after the war's over. And I think the West should put pressure on those still there to say, if you are paying taxes to Putin's government as a foreign company, you are funding an immoral, horrific, barbaric war against Ukraine, and you should stop doing that now.
What's the most important sanction policy the West should be thinking about using right now?
Top of the list for me personally is Russian central bank assets. We froze those assets, about $360 billion. We froze those assets. I think now we should transfer those assets to the Ukrainians. That is money of the Russian government. I think it would be immoral to send that money back to Russia. And I think, frankly, it's kind of immoral that American taxpayers have to pay for economic assistance to Ukraine and eventually for economic reconstruction of Ukraine if we don't first use that Russian money that are sitting in banks in the West.
Michael McFaul is a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. He's also the director of the Freeman Spolyi Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Ambassador McFaul, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
We all know the economy of Saudi Arabia is built on oil, and there's plenty more of that to keep things going. Still, in recent years, the kingdom has been moving forward with plans to develop its own nuclear energy program. It's in the early days, but as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, the idea of a nuclear Saudi Arabia is raising concerns.
Saudi Arabia has options when it comes to energy. Beyond oil, that part of the world also gets a lot of sun and wind. So why invest in a nuclear program?
I've been to Saudi Arabia. I have talked to the people in the nuclear program in Saudi Arabia.
Mark Hibbs is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Saudi Arabia knows that the world is moving away from fossil fuels. And one of the things that the Saudi Arabian government is concerned about is the possibility that if they do not adjust to a world without fossil fuels, they will be subject to possible sanctions and trade embargoes.
He says there are other reasons why the kingdom wants a nuclear program. The country's population is growing, and it's been moving towards a more technology-based economy and society. There are plans to build megacities and attract tourists. All of that requires more electrical power.
So it would be, from that point of view, perfectly logical for Saudi Arabia to enhance its technology portfolio in the energy sector by moving in toward the development of nuclear power.
But here's the issue. Any country with its own nuclear program could decide to take steps towards building nuclear weapons. Currently, there are no signs that Saudi Arabia is doing that, but comments made by the Crown Prince back in 2018 did raise concerns. Here's Mohammed bin Salman speaking to CBS News.
Does Saudi Arabia need nuclear weapons to counter Iran?
Saudi Arabia does not want to acquire any nuclear bomb. But without a doubt, if Iran developed a nuclear bomb, we will follow suit as soon as possible.
Relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia have been contentious in recent years. Iran supports the Houthis in the war in Yemen. The group claimed responsibility for carrying out an attack on Saudi oil facilities in 2019. Iran also has its own advanced nuclear program. The U.S. and a group of other countries have been working on a deal to prevent it from developing nuclear weapons. Those talks have stalled. The Saudi Minister for Foreign Affairs, Adel Al-Jubayr, was asked about Iran in an interview with CNBC at the World Economic Forum in Davos this week.
I believe that Iran has an obligation to give up its nuclear program. I believe that the Iran must be in compliance with the terms of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and Iran...
Mark Hibbs says it would be costly for the Saudis to develop nuclear weapons.
The question that Saudi Arabia in that situation must answer is whether or not doing that would increase its security. I would argue that the decisions that Iran has taken in this area have not benefited Iran, and Saudi Arabia knows that.
Iran claims it does not have a nuclear weapons program. Still, the country's economy has been heavily sanctioned. The government has been ostracized by most of the international community. Ellen Wald is a fellow with the Atlantic Council and author of a book called Saudi Inc. She says there is an interest in the region in general to develop nuclear energy technology.
I think that they realize that it's really bad both economically and environmentally to burn oil.
The United Arab Emirates opened a nuclear reactor recently, she says. But Walt says she doesn't see this as a nuclear race in the Middle East. It's something that makes more sense economically and environmentally.
I don't know if I would go so far as to say it's like clean or green because nuclear waste stays around for a long time, but it doesn't have the same kind of carbon emissions that fossil fuels have.
Saudi Arabia has been talking with potential partners in China, Russia, South Korea, and the U.S. about its nuclear ambitions. Argentina helped build a research reactor outside of Riyadh. But Mark Hibbs from the Carnegie Endowment says this project will take years to complete.
Saudi Arabia is graced with the opportunity of being able to move that timetable up, in part because it has financial resources, which many, many other countries could only dream about.
Hibbs says more and more countries will be looking into building up their own nuclear energy capabilities in the future. Deepening safety and global security will inevitably be part of this shift. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The ancient Egyptians were known to mummify people and animals, like cats, but also crocodiles. This week, the American scientific journal PLOS ONE published research on 10 mummified crocodiles. They were discovered by Spanish archaeologists. Dr. Bia de Cupra works at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Brussels, and she led the research. She spoke with the Turkish Cultural Institute and said it's important to study animal remains to better understand the past and the relationship between humans and animals.
For example, they will tell us something about hunting and fishing strategies. They will tell something about the domestication of certain mammals and birds, which domestic species was kept, why were they kept? Was it for their meat? Was it for their milk? Was it for the physical power?
In the case of crocodiles, it appears they were kept to honor the Egyptian god Sobek, a god of the Nile, as explained by the History Channel.
The ancient Egyptians chose a lot of their gods based on the natural world, and crocodiles are large, terrifying things, so they wanted to appease them.
Appease them by mummifying crocodiles for eternity. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. China is entering the Lunar New Year this weekend. It'll be the Year of the Rabbit. For many people in China, it will be the first New Year's since the start of the pandemic where they'll be able to travel back to their hometowns. That's because 3 years of travel restrictions and lockdowns and all those COVID rules have been lifted. But that doesn't mean the coronavirus is gone. The World's Rebecca Canther traveled to central Hunan province to visit her in-laws for the holiday. Rebecca, what's the mood where you are?
There's definitely a lot of excitement to finally be able to be with family again at this time of year. We traveled by train from Shanghai. There were huge crowds at the train station. That's something I haven't seen in a long time. Before the pandemic, this travel season was known as the biggest annual migration on the planet. This year, many people are back on the road again, and reports are that this year's travel rush is just 70% of what it was before the pandemic. When we were traveling, masks were required on the train, and I saw some people wearing goggles and face shields as well. It was really strange to travel without any need to test for COVID beforehand. There were no public health workers wearing white hazmat suits, no health codes to scan. All those restrictions have disappeared.
What's the COVID situation where you are, Rebecca?
I'm in a small town in Hunan province. And when I go out, it seems like about half the people I see are wearing masks and the other half are not. Earlier this month, local health officials in Hunan announced 88 million people have already been infected here.
Wow.
That's nearly 90% of the population. So there's concern that the travel rush will lead to a second wave of outbreaks in rural areas. But at least where I am, everyone I've talked to says they've already gotten COVID in late December and are recovered. Many elderly people here did die. Nationwide, China reported 60,000 deaths from COVID since December. But that only covers deaths in the hospital. Reports in state media say the peak of infections has passed, but that hospitals are still not past the worst of it.
With the spike in COVID cases, what's the atmosphere there like going into this holiday weekend?
Today was the last market day before the New Year holiday. The streets were bustling with people buying decorations, food, holiday gifts. People were also buying firecrackers at makeshift street stalls. Fireworks have been banned here since 2019 for environmental reasons, but this year there were petitions to loosen the ban. A few weeks ago, this video went viral. Some young people in a nearby city set off fireworks illegally, and when the police arrived, they overturned a police car to protest. Recently, several cities announced they'll loosen the ban on fireworks this year for this New Year period as a way to boost people's moods and the economy. In the town where I am, the ban has been lifted, but supplies are extremely limited. But as usual, Carol, I'm hearing a lot of fireworks going off here in Hunan.
Now, earlier this week, China put out some worrying numbers for the economy. How do things look in the town where you are?
The pandemic has hit China's economy hard. New figures show that China's GDP last year grew just 3%. That's one of the worst in the nation's history. Here where I am in Hunan, many small businesses depend on this shopping season for a good portion of their income. I talked with Zhang Xinshan. He owns a butcher stall in town. It seemed busy there today. People were crowding around buying roast duck, sausage, and pig ears before the holiday. Zhang tells me that people are just more spendthrift these days and not willing to splurge. And that's something I heard from other business people, too. But this holiday goes on for another couple weeks, so the travel rush will really go until the middle of next month.
Thanks so much, Rebecca, and Happy New Year.
Thank you, Carol.
And next time on The World, we continue to celebrate the Lunar New Year. While the Chinese are traveling for the first time in 3 years, that's not the case in Taiwan. Quarantine-free travel opened up there last fall. Non-Taiwanese families are welcoming loved ones home, some who've been stuck abroad since before the pandemic. We have the story of a Lunar New Year family reunion in Taiwan next time on The World. Teachers, nurses, and pensioners are making their voices heard in Venezuela. This demonstration took place earlier this week on the streets of San Felipe. Across Venezuela, there's been some of the biggest protests in years. That's because public workers have seen their salaries eroded by inflation. It climbed 300% last year. The World's Tibi Saisaya reports.
Belkis Bolívar is a public school teacher in the Venezuelan capital, Caracas.
Mi nombre es Belkis Bolívar. Soy maestra de escuela, trabajo en una escuela pública en la parroquia Antímeno.
Bolívar says that last summer, her monthly salary was worth about $50. Now, she says it's about $14 because of the devaluation of the local currency. And that's just a small fraction of what it takes to feed a family of four every month.
Entonces, bueno, vendo comidas por encargo.
She says she makes takeout meals to sell to people and teaches French lessons at home to supplement her income. She says many of her colleagues drive taxis or do manicures in addition to teaching, just to get by. Venezuela's national economy has shown some signs of recovery in the last couple of years. That's because oil prices have rebounded and the government has lifted some controls on the economy. But the recovery doesn't translate into a better quality of life for many Venezuelans. Omar Zambrano is a professor of economic development at the Andrés Bello Catholic University in Caracas. He says people who work in the private sector and get paid in U.S. dollars are doing much better than those whose salary is paid in bolivars, the national currency.
Because you are a public employee or you are retired receiving income in hyperinflated bolivars, you are not in a good position to consume.
Meaning they don't have much purchasing power. The Venezuelan government has been reducing public spending, and that includes freezing salaries of public employees last year. Still, the country has one of the highest inflation rates in the world. School infrastructure has suffered from spending cuts, says Belkis Bolívar. The school where she works hasn't had access to running water for years. And now, most of the school meal programs are suspended. She says students have been fainting in class because they don't have enough to eat. As much as 70% of public school teachers in Venezuela have either left the country or abandoned their professions in the last 8 years. That's according to a recent university study. The Venezuelan government blames U.S. sanctions for the troubled economy. But economist José Guerra says the crisis started way before the sanctions.
¿Qué hicieron las sanciones? Exacerbaron una crisis, pero no la generaron.
Sanctions made this crisis worse, he says, but they didn't create it. It was really corruption and mismanagement that ruined the country, Guerra says. School teachers in Caracas are planning a big demonstration for Monday. They are demanding a living wage. In the past, President Nicolás Maduro's government has cracked down violently against protesters. But he might be reluctant to do so now because Maduro is hoping that Washington will agree to unfreeze $3 billion in Venezuelan assets. For the World, I'm Tibisay Sea.
Coming up in the next half hour, more layoffs in Silicon Valley and what that means for foreign workers in the U.S. You're listening to The World. More layoffs in Silicon Valley. A lot of people getting pink slips are there on H-1B visas, and their immigration status is tied to having a job.
So whenever there's a job available, all of these people will be applying. Most of them will not be getting those jobs, and they'll be left wondering, what do they do with themselves?
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH and PRX. In Iran, protests continue despite the regime's heavy-handed crackdown, which has included death sentences for some. Even Iranians who live thousands of miles from their home country feel they're under threat. One is Iranian-Canadian podcaster Ramin Sayed Emami. He goes by King Ram, and on his popular show, he discusses things considered taboo in conservative Iranian culture. From Toronto, reporter Anita Elash has more. امشب همون شبیه که من بدون تو خونه میرم. In Farsi, the podcast is called Masti o Rasti. In English, that's The Drunken Truth. Both drunkenness and truth play a prominent role.
سلام دوستان. من رام هستم.
In episode one, Mami is honest about his drug use and talks about his first experience using ayahuasca.
برای این اپیزود من یه ذره بوربن خوردم و یه چند تا پیسم کتامین زدم.
He tells listeners that he and his guests will be drunk or high throughout the series to encourage honesty. He suggests bourbon or the party drug ketamine, but only in reasonable doses.
Microdose nasal spray.
In other episodes, Imami touches on much more serious emotional and societal issues, such as losing religious faith, sex, mental health, and the Iranian Me Too movement. Many of his guests are ordinary young Iranians who still live in Iran, talking about their lives. Like this man, who described how he had been sexually assaulted in a park as a teenager, but had never dared to talk about the incident in public. Imami asks him how he has dealt with the trauma. The man says he hasn't really, and doesn't visit parks anymore. Imami started making the podcast in March of 2020. He already had a reputation as a punk rock musician, but he was depressed about the pandemic and about his life.
I was in a really dark place when I started the podcast. I was going to record 10 episodes and then kill myself.
At first, he focused on his own stories. His father was an environmentalist who died in an Iranian prison in 2018. His mother was barred from leaving Iran for more than a year. Imami says he wanted people to understand what his family had been through. But within a few weeks, he had a massive following, mostly in Iran.
It's not easy, these type of things, bearing the unbearable. And I just wanted to share that experience in as much of a raw and honest way as I could. People were like, this guy has gone completely mad. Like, what is he on about? But the more I talked, the more people connected to, I guess, the method of my madness.
It turned out the Iranian government may have been listening too. After 15 months and dozens of episodes, a member of Canada's spy agency came to Imami's home. He told Imami about a hit list of Iranians being targeted on Canadian soil.
But they hadn't identified where the threat was coming from. They were trying to figure out how to protect these individuals within Canada.
Though they wouldn't tell him for sure if he's on that list. National security expert Thomas Juneau says it fits a pattern of intimidation and threats against Iranian Canadians or their families in Iran. The people making the threats are thought to be backed by the Iranian government.
In some cases, they are sympathizers. In other cases, they are Iranian officials who are covertly in Canada.
Juneau says Canadians have known about those threats, but were slow to act on them.
Successive governments have acted in the face of threats only when the problem has accumulated, only when there has been significant attention by civil society, activists, and others.
Imami says he increased his own security after his visit with the Canadian spy agency, but his podcast hasn't changed.
After they killed my father and took our mother hostage and took everything we had away, like, what do you have to lose at this point? I mean, I have nothing to fear.
Early on in the podcast, Imami invited listeners to leave him voice messages, telling their stories and sharing their hopes and dreams for the future of their country. He plays them regularly. Here, a young man says he dreams of open internet access. A woman says freedom would mean choosing what to wear and respecting sexual orientation. Another dreams of having adventures and educational opportunities instead of working so hard just to survive.
And the voices are so powerful and so emotional. And it's such simple requests that it seems almost comical to a Western listener.
Imami says it's those kinds of stories and requests that resonate with people and have the power to change things. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
The Australian Open is bringing the heat in more ways than one. The first week of the Grand Slam tennis competition was marked by wild weather and some impressive games. The World's Bianca Hillier is here to fill us in. Hey, Bianca.
Hey there, Carol.
Now, there was a lot of weather delays throughout this first week. How did that impact play?
Yeah, these major delays really started on Tuesday when temperatures soared to 98 degrees. So officials called it. They had players take a break. But then when the players went back on the court later that afternoon and evening, there was a torrential downpour. So bad timing, bad luck for them. Many of those Tuesday matches got pushed to Wednesday. And then it just took a few days for all of that backlog to get caught up. But this weekend should be dry and in the 70s in Melbourne as players work their way toward the quarterfinals.
Now, I'm sure everyone down under, as they say, is glad to hear that. But once the matches did get going, what stood out?
So once they got going, they went on and on and on. Multiple matches went past midnight. And Andy Murray's game against Thanasi Kokkinakis went way past midnight. Murray was not happy about this. He screamed on the court, "Why are we playing at 3 a.m.?" And he told the umpire it was disrespectful to keep players and ball kids out on the court without a second bathroom break, which, yeah, that does sound pretty difficult.
Yeah.
They ended up playing for 5 hours and 45 minutes, which is the second longest match in Australian Open history. And the crowd stayed throughout all of it. I mean, those seats were packed, and they made it a lot of fun, a lot of Aussie, Aussie, Aussie chants for local Kokkinakis. But in the end, it was Murray who walked away with the win at just past 4 a.m. local time. Here's what he said right after.
It's obviously amazing to win the match, but I want to go to bed now. If my child was a ball kid and they're coming home at 5 a.m, as a parent, I'm snapping at that. Like, it's not beneficial for them. It's not beneficial for the umpires, the officials. I don't think it's amazing for the fans.
Tournament head Craig Tiley responded to this today. He said there are no plans to alter the schedule at this point.
So why are they going so late?
Tiley says this was because of that scheduling jam caused by the weather delays. You know, everything was pushed back, trying to get a lot of matches in each day. But players across the tournament are pointing to the balls being used. Rafael Nadal complained that they don't spin as much as he's used to, which in his case, that's messing up his revered and feared topspin. And other players are saying that they aren't as bouncy as usual. And in a press conference, Novak Djokovic explained how this led to longer matches.
The tennis ball has changed this year. I mean, the longer you play, the more rallies you play, the fluffier or the bigger the ball becomes, and it's slower. So that affects the play. I think we are going to see more of those longer duration of matches this year than we have maybe last year. One of the biggest reasons will probably be the ball.
Wow, I mean, who would have thought of that? What's going on with the ball?
Event organizers did not respond to my request for comment on these complaints, but it's a story we'll keep watching.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Now, despite these obstacles, who has been showing up on the court? Any breakout stars?
Absolutely. There always are. And this week, it's really been fun to watch Shan Jung Cheng. He's a 17-year-old who on Monday became the first Chinese man to ever win a match at the Australian Open. Shang has been rising up the ranks for the past couple of years, but this is his first Grand Slam. And despite getting knocked out of the competition on Wednesday in a really tough match, Shang said he enjoyed every moment out on the court. So remember that name. We'll be hearing about him for sure.
I certainly will. And how about the women's matches? Who are the top contenders for the trophy at the moment?
It's always hard to say until that final match is on. But right now, professional women's tennis is at a really unique turning point, if you will, with so many key players recently retired or out of commission for this tournament. In fact, this is the first major field without any woman with 4 or more Grand Slam titles since 2003. Some of these players weren't even born in 2003. So the opportunity to make a name for yourself and grab the trophy is wide open, and a group of U.S. players are looking really strong, including 18-year-old American Katie Volinets. She snagged what's being called the biggest upset of the tournament so far. Volinets defeated number 9 seed Veronika Kudermetova of Russia. Still, overall, top-seeded Iga Świątek from Poland is arguably the favorite to win at this point, and she'll play next in the fourth round on Saturday.
The world's Bianca Hillier covers sports for us and has been following the Australian Open. Bianca, thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you, Carol.
Now an update on a story we brought you a couple of weeks ago. Iraq had been hosting an international soccer tournament for the first time in 4 decades, the Gulf Cup Soccer, which features 8 nations around the Persian Gulf. The finals were yesterday in the Iraqi port city of Basra. The host country pulled it off. Iraq defeated Oman 3-2 to win the tournament for the first time since 1988. It was quite a moment. But sadly, the victory was marred by tragedy. At least 2 people were killed in a stampede before the game when thousands of fans without tickets tried to push into the stadium. Dozens of other fans were injured in the crush. Many remain in critical condition. Cate Blanchett is a favorite to win her 3rd Oscar for her performance portraying a musical genius in the film Tar. Blanchett plays the role of Lydia Tar, a conductor of the famed Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. The movie has split opinions among real-life female conductors, but it's also put a spotlight on the obstacles they face. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Alice Farnham has been conducting orchestras in Britain going back to the 1990s. She's watched the new Cate Blanchett movie twice. The first time was after the star of the film encouraged her to go see it.
Cate Blanchett wrote to me back in June and said that she'd listened to something I'd done for BBC and she was interested. She wanted me to see the film. And I'm fascinated by it.
Lydia Tarr, Cate Blanchett's character, is at the pinnacle of her career in the movie. And she's a very contentious relationship with her students.
I mean, unfortunately, the architect of your soul appears to be social media. You want to dance the mask, you must service the composer. You got to sublimate yourself, your ego, and yes, your identity. You must, in fact, stand in front of the public and God and obliterate yourself.
And without giving too much away, she's also a little unhinged. Maren Alsop, the world-renowned US conductor, is name-checked in the film. But after watching the movie, Alsop told the Sunday Times that she found it offensive. To finally have an opportunity to portray a woman in that role and to make her an abuser, Alsop said, was heartbreaking to see. Conductor Alice Farnham doesn't see it that way.
It's clearly fictional because, I mean, the character of Lydia Tarr is pretty monstrous. I don't know any female conductors like that, thankfully.
Cate Blanchett defended the film during her recent press tour. Here she's speaking to the BBC a few days ago.
Look, I have the utmost respect for Maren Alsop. She's a trailblazer. What Todd and I wanted to do was to create a really lively conversation. It's not a film about conducting. It's a meditation on power, and power is genderless.
All the same, British conductor Alice Farnham says this movie could not have been made 10 years ago because no one would have believed then that a woman would be chosen to lead the world's top orchestra. Back in the 1990s, Farnham says there were only a handful of professional female conductors she could really look up to. So much so that Farnham often ended up having to persuade people she could do the job.
I didn't fit that image of a conductor. So that was a barrier that it wasn't normal to see a woman. So you had to convince people that despite the way you looked, which was a woman, it was unusual. So it was hard for people to imagine you doing the job.
2 decades later, Farnham says, she realised little had changed. In 2014, just over 1% of conductors leading professional orchestras in Britain were women. So Farnham set out to do something about it. She put together workshops to encourage women to enter the profession. And over the last 10 years, she's become a mentor to many young female conductors, like Sinead Hayes from Galway in Ireland. Today, Hayes leads the Hard Rain Ensemble, a contemporary orchestra in Belfast. Hayes works with classical music orchestras in Ireland too. She tells me she's never been conscious of her gender while working with musicians, but she says it's the gatekeepers, the people who decide who will lead an orchestra, who can often make or break a conductor's career.
I think it was always seen as a slightly riskier bet to sign a woman, you know, and I see a few friends of mine who are conductors taking some time to have children, which, you know, takes some time, like, and it takes a lot of brain space. So there is that, and there's that perception that, okay, well, in terms of money, that will be less if the conductor they sign is working less.
Jerry Lynn Johnson knows about the power of those gatekeepers. In 2007, Johnson, who's African-American, applied for a prominent role as an orchestra's musical director. She didn't get the job, but after the audition, she was offered some feedback.
And the chair of the search committee said, look, you just don't look like what our orchestra expects the quote-unquote maestro to look like.
Johnson was furious, but she says that brutal honesty drove her to set up her own ensemble in Philadelphia a year later. The Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra features musicians from very diverse backgrounds. Johnson has also led several other orchestras, both in the US and Europe, over the last 20 years. Still, she says, there are times when audiences seem taken aback when she steps on stage.
Sometimes, especially when I'm doing opera, they don't realize that I am the conductor. So I'll come up from the pit onto the stage and people kind of stop clapping because they're not sure who I am. I'm not, you know, the white guy in the tuxedo. So they don't know who I am until I have the stick and they're like, oh, she was the conductor.
Johnson has also seen Tar, the new Cate Blanchett film, and she says she found it uncomfortable to watch. But it's getting people talking, she says, about the dearth of female conductors at the highest level in classical music. And that, Johnson says, can only be a good thing. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Amazon, 18,000 jobs. Microsoft, 10,000. Meta, 11,000. And now Google. Google's parent company, Alphabet, says it plans to cut 12,000 jobs. Many of those getting pink slips will be visa holders whose immigration status is tied to their employer. Joining me now to discuss this is Tamina Watson. She's an immigration lawyer at Watson Immigration Law in Seattle. Tamina, how many calls have you been getting in recent months from people on work visas laid off from tech companies?
A lot of calls. And they actually started, I would say, around August, September last year. And of course, you know, today's news from Alphabet will likely lead to a lot of other calls, too.
Many of these people who are being laid off are H-1B visa holders. Remind us what that visa is used for and the types of people who typically hold it.
The H-1B visa is the skilled professional visa that is used in the United States, 85,000 visas each year. So somebody has to win the quote-unquote lottery to be selected, and then they will have 6 years to be in the U.S. And to be able to stay beyond 6 years, they will have to have a green card application pending.
So when someone with an H-1B visa gets laid off, what happens?
They are out of status. They must be working to remain in the United States. Although in 2017, the Obama era had created a policy allowing people to have 60 days to stay in the U.S. if they lose their jobs.
And how realistic is that time period for your clients to find new jobs?
Very unrealistic. And as each day goes by, it becomes even more challenging and people are seeing darkness ahead. And we start 2023 with a bang, you know, Salesforce, Goldman Sachs, and you named several. And these companies have also implemented hiring freezes. So whenever there's a job available, all of these people will be applying. Most of them will not be getting those jobs and they'll be left wondering, what do they do with themselves?
As you mentioned, many H-1B holders try to get green cards while they're here with the H-1Bs. How do these layoffs affect their green card applications?
It is going to be devastating for them. A lot of the tech workers in this country are from India and China, and these people have a much longer waiting time to get a green card. Now, these green cards are for future jobs. And so if these jobs go away, then the green card application is now in jeopardy.
As an immigration lawyer, what kind of policy changes do you think would help this situation?
The solutions that I have been advocating for are, number one, asking for the Department of Homeland Security to extend the grace period beyond 60 days. A lot of people are asking for 60 extra days, so there can be 120 days. But at a minimum, they need an extension of those 60 days. Because 60 days is not enough to find a job, figure out what you're going to do with the mortgage and the house and the children and what have you. The second thing is that we do absolutely need immigration reform. Everything is interconnected. You know, the green card line, so to speak, that has needed reform for many decades. It hasn't been touched for decades. And lastly, I do advocate for having a new visa category called the startup visa. The startup visa will allow allow people who are innovative and creative to use funds from angel investors or venture capital firms to create new companies and new innovation that we want to keep in the United States.
Tamina Watson is an immigration lawyer at Watson Immigration Law in Seattle. Thanks a lot, Tamina.
Thank you so much.
It can be hard to make a living as a craftsperson, but a handmade piece of furniture, a pot, or kitchenware, that can become a cherished family heirloom. In a city in southeastern Turkey, copper handiwork has been passed down through generations. Artists in Gaziantep are famous for making hammered kitchenware and decorative objects. But as the world's Duri Buscarin reports, those artists are now facing stiff competition from mass production.
Wrapped in a sweatshirt and warm scarf, Orhan Duymaz uses a small chisel to engrave a bright copper serving dish, stopping every so often to sand down the edges. Up close, you can see a garden of flowers, fountains, and geometric swirls. Generally, I use a tulip motif, Duymaz says. But his designs have Roman, Ottoman, and Persian influences, he says. It's kind of a mix. Duymaz sits in a shop in Gaziantep's Copper Bazaar. Shelves of decorative copper pots and tea samovars reach up to the ceiling. His father, who sits beside him, has worked with copper since he was 8, back when people used to sing while they worked. Mehmet Duymaz is 83 years old. He learned this craft from his own father back in 1948. When he was a child, Duymaz says, he and his father would strap their wares to donkeys to transport them from the village to the bazaar. Everyone used copper implements to cook, he says. Special pots were used to make rice or yogurt, even tea. Back then, about 400 people used to work in the copper bazaar. It's just a fraction of that today. Now, Duymaz says, it seems like everyone just goes to a department store and buys mass-produced items for less than half the price. Humans have been working copper for at least 10,000 years. The old city of Antep, known as Gaziantep in modern Turkey, is strategically placed along trading routes and has long been a hub for copper exports. During the Ottoman Empire, most of Antep's coppersmiths were Armenian. Many of these families were killed or deported during the Armenian genocide, and Kurdish and Turkish tradesmen took over. Many coppersmiths today are their descendants.
Biz Ermenilerden öğrendik bu meslekleri.
Armenians taught us this trade, says Şerif Açıkalın. He runs a shop on one end of the copper bazaar, where he repairs sound equipment. It grew out of his father's business making copper gramophone horns. Like many coppersmiths, Açıkalın fears that the trade is no longer in demand, that the next generation doesn't see it as a profitable career.
Unutulmuş bir meslekler bunlar. Devamı gelmeyen.
They'll forget this trade, he says, and it won't live on. Coppersmith Erkan Kaynar has adapted in a different way. He makes artistic sculptures and public installations out of copper. He remembers when an American artist visited the bazaar to learn traditional hammering techniques. Afterwards, Kaynar learned that the American is now selling his own etched copper plates for $600 a piece back in the U.S. It upsets him.
Bu işe 50 yılını, 60 yılını vermiş bu motiflerin...
We, the craftsmen, have worked for 50 years to do this, and will never earn this kind of money, he said. For the world, I'm Duri Buscarin, in Gaziantep, Turkey.
That's where we wrap today. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a groovy weekend. From PRX.